from MLU headquarters in Philadelphia.
You should go underneath it.
Oh, way out deep!
This is Cleats and Cuffy.
Hit it! Oh, what a one! Murray!
Everything ultimate, from the field to the border, with Jeff Snyder and Nick Dark.
Hang it up there!
Oh, yes!
Hello,
Mr. Graham!
Here we are. Cleats and Cufflinks. Coming from the new office today, Jeffrey.
Episode Blackjack.
Episode Blackjack. Right. Fine, it's about time. Yeah, we're coming from our brand new office space. How are you liking it in here? How are you feeling?
It's very nice. We tweeted a picture or two, but nothing too much. It is so much bigger than our last office, and we're sitting in quite the spacious room right now.
We are. I think you can tell by the resonance.
You think they can hear that?
I don't know if they can hear it. I wonder if they can hear. We have some new background noise that we're unaccustomed to. There's just a plane overhead.
We'll paint the picture for you. We're at 509 Vine Street in Philadelphia.
Yep.
So we upgraded neighborhoods a little bit in terms of business location, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, our proximity to Center City has improved.
Yeah.
Let's say that.
This is 3,200 square feet?
3,400
square feet. So right now we're in the kind of entertainment room, hangout room. It's big. I don't know how to describe how big it is, but you could fit five ping pong tables in here.
Yeah, it's big enough that we were playing a pretty robust game of Pig, the basketball style game, with nothing but a can jam container and a soccer ball.
Yeah.
So enough room to do that.
And the ceilings are high. These are 20-foot ceilings,
yep.
Which is nice because it's kind of a half basement.
Yeah, we're about half submerged. Got a little bit of natural light coming in, not a lot. You don't necessarily know for sure what the weather's doing outside, but you can speculate.
if it gets darker, it just means the snow's filling up.
Yeah, it means we've drifted over. So
we have a breakout room, which people can go to work in, like to have meetings in. We have a front desk area.
Yeah.
We have a kind of, but there's the common area where everyone sits.
The bullpen, if you will.
We have the sales office.
Nice big room for them. Too big, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiling them.
We have the video office.
Yeah, the production suite, let's call it.
Production suite.
Yeah.
And we have a private conference room.
We do. And we also have a significant storage area.
And an enormous storage area.
And so, access to a freight elevator.
Yes.
I mean, this is the real world.
Yeah.
We're living in the real world of offices. We no longer have things.
Okay, things we love. Let's
we
do.
No longer have two kitchens.
Two kitchens.
Two full kitchens
right.
with stoves and refrigerators.
True.
We don't have that anymore. We no longer have two showers.
True.
We're down to zero showers.
Zero showers.
We've significantly fewer showers.
Yes.
I think I could say. We no longer have two sets of washers and dryers. We no longer have a live-in Greg Fallon.
That's true.
Which I'm a little sad about.
So for those who didn't know, we were renting a full apartment complex. I don't know how you say that.
Like a building. We were renting a three-story apartment building.
Yeah, so the basement was just a bare basement with nothing much in it. And the second floor was an apartment. And that's why Nick's making the joke of there was a washer, dryer, shower, kitchen. And then the third floor was the same thing as the second floor.
Yeah, another apartment.
So we just used them all as offices. And in the second floor, one of the rooms was Greg Fallon's room.
Our caretaker, if you will.
Yes.
Yeah. And what I loved about it was I would tend to get there during a lot of that time a little bit on the early side because I lived a 10-minute walk away, which I'm going to miss. I'm going to tell you that. I'm going to miss that a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. And it was kind of nice to, sit down, get my cup of coffee, open up my computer, and have Greg walk out of the shower room in his boxer shorts. And it just felt like the day began.
The day
sunrise,
began. There
if you
he is.
Will. Yeah.
There he is, bright and early.
Wakes you right
He's
up.
He's a rooster, when that sun comes up.
Just wakes you right up.
Yeah, he wakes up and then goes back to sleep for 3 hours, and then he's awake.
Yeah,
but
perfect. It was a great office for us from the start. We started on the first floor of that place when we first started this company.
Which it was only a first-story building.
That's all there was. It was a one-story building. And then they built two stories above us in what has become known to the people who were in the office at the time, which Tom, right, Greg, were both there. And that's become known as the period of the robot wars, because whatever they were doing upstairs sounded like robots fighting each other when they were building the upstairs. But yeah, we grew up in that building, I'd say. And so there's some nostalgia there for me.
Now, you know where – oh, yeah. You know when your mother said, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
So we would have people to our office, our old office. lots of times, right? We had lots of people. We would hold our investor conferences there. Numerous people would visit us. And every time they would come up, they'd always be like, hey, this is a neat little place, right?
Oh,
yeah. Neat place. And or they would say whatever. But you could tell. It was like, well, these guys, Major League Ultimate, works out of an apartment.
Yeah, right? It's a little weird. Like, you're working out of, like, there's literally a stove behind you.
Yeah. So I don't think it was viewed as, I wouldn't say a negative. But
no.
It was viewed as, this is very startup.
I mean, it was a cool place because the access to Frankfurt Hall and all the places we like to take people and hang out was great. And I think people enjoyed the startup feel of it. I remember we brought one of our main investors there for a meeting when we were just in the downstairs floor. Do you remember this? It was winter.
Oh, they had to wrap him in
blankets. It was so cold.
Yeah.
And he said never again.
So, yeah. So, yeah, and also you looked it up on Google Maps, right next door to it, the building was kind of abandoned. So that took away from the look of our building. So anyway, people sometimes just would – you could tell what they were thinking.
Yeah, of course.
And then Antoine just walked in today, and he lost his mind. Everyone who comes in here is like, wow.
Yeah, okay. The new place is a stunning difference. I mean, it is a full-on office, and it is full of people.
Yes.
We're already jamming in here and thinking about where we're going to put more people.
This place is awesome. And so a special thank you to Danny. Do you know his last name, the building owner?
Now you're putting me on the spot.
Great guy, Danny.
Great guy.
And Jennifer of Stonehenge, right?
That's Jennifer Boyle. Yep, Stonehenge. Boyle.
And if you're interested, well, he just told me they are completely booked. But if you're a young professional with a pet, which seems like this is where this building caters to.
Yeah, so
this is awesome.
So to be clear, the ground floor where we are is commercial. Everything above us is residential and really cool loft buildings with great views of the city.
Yeah, I would.
We
live
got
here
to
in
go
a
up and walk
second.
There. Oh, it's a fantastic building.
I would live here in a second as a young professional in a second.
Absolutely,
because it was awesome. So we're in a new office. Open invite if you want to come here and spend time with Nick. Just give him a. Just at Nick Darling on Twitter. If you want to spend time with me, just, again, at Nick Darling on Twitter. But we haven't done podcasts in a little bit because of the move.
Yeah, the moves are rough.
Yeah.
It's a lot of stuff.
So let me give credit to our team.
Oh, yes.
Because you and I have been through moves. Okay, so when you're moving anything, and this is, look, if you need advice on moves, there's just a simple one. Just it's done in a day.
Yep.
Don't ever move and say, well, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to come back and just do it all in one day. You just have to...
One truckload if you can.
Yeah, like everything's done. So we moved completely out of our old place, cleaned it spotless, and moved into the new place with everything that needed to be put in its proper room in its proper room in one day. So the team was awesome.
It was amazing. Yeah. And, you know, it was a lot of buildup to get there. A lot of people packing and inventorying and making sure everything was ready to go. But, yeah, that move day was they killed it.
Yeah. And I got to drive a 26-foot diesel, and I didn't hurt myself or anyone else.
Which, I got to be honest, I was shocked by because I left right ahead of you, and you took a long time to get here. I was pretty sure you were
I got stuck making a left turn because someone parked in a weird way, and then he ran out and moved. And I took it slow because let me tell you what, that thing was moving.
It's a big thing, car.
It's a big, big thing. So we did it one day and we're feeling pretty good. And so now we're back. And I also got the flu.
You did, yeah, which not normal for you.
No,
you tend to be a pretty healthy fella.
But my wife came home. Here's how bad it was. My wife's hospital has so many nurses and people calling out that they were trying to get nurses from other hospitals. Like, that's how bad it was. So... Lori, we quarantined her.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. Basement, I assume.
Yeah.
Little water.
The normal place.
Bowl of food.
Keep her away from my 4-year-old and my 6-month-year-old.
Yeah.
6 month year old.
Yeah. How did that go, by the way?
Okay. Well, that's, but yeah. Thanks for asking. so she finally feels better, and then both of my kids get sick.
Yeah.
And they dealt with it well, which, you know, you're worried. A 6 month old, you get worried about how
you do.
They get sick, but they were both dealing with it really well. But my youngest wouldn't sleep more than an hour. So I got Lori kind of knocked out and still tired. Autumn sleeping, and my youngest Kaylee is waking me up every hour, right? And I'm going in there and I'm picking her up because she needed to be picked up so that her nose was so clogged.
Yeah, so she could drain some stuff out of there. Yeah, I'm with you.
So I'm sitting there holding her and do this one night, and I do it the second night. And there was a moment where I'm holding her, and this was the second I would pick her up too. It was kind of adorable. She would get comfortable on my shoulder. I'm like, this is adorable. I wish you were asleep, laying flat, right? But so we're doing this whole thing, and there's this moment where I felt the virus come in.
You could feel it like, make the
he's
jump.
Weak. And I just went back, and I'm like, this is bad. And I ended up waking up 2 days later with 102.5 or 9 or something like that degree fever. I don't remember getting a fever like that in quite some time. So let me tell you, if someone has this flu, get away from it, because it was just, it wipes you out. You're just... It's like not a lot of coughing, no sore throat, nothing. Just high fever,
brutal fever,
and you're not going to move around. So, oof, it was tough.
Yeah.
But all right, we got things to discuss.
Yeah, we've that's a lot of banter.
All right. Yeah.
But I felt good about it.
People love to know.
It's been
a
while since we've talked.
They miss us. So we have three segments today.
Three segments.
Okay. Number one, we're going to talk about Deflategate.
Deflategate.
And we're going to talk about how we would handle it here in the MLU. What we think of how the NFL is handling it.
Yeah, we're going to have that discussion.
Segment two, Friday Night Tykes. Oof. It's a show that I watched that you've watched a few clips
yeah,
of.
Yeah, I've seen some clips of it, and that was kind of enough for me. I don't know if I could sit through a whole show, but yeah. we'll get to that.
I have some talking points to that. And then segment number three is Jordan Belfort's Four Keys to Life Success. Now, I'm a huge Jordan Belfort fan.
I'm aware of that.
But I don't take into account any of his past. I take into account what the teacher he is at the moment. You don't like him. You can admit it. You don't like it. We're going to talk about these things he's talked about and see if they're good advice or how you would differ your advice or whatever you think about for young entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
But he brings up really good points. And we don't have any questions. So I was hoping to tweet out about some questions. We don't have any.
You know, we didn't do the thing where we asked.
Yeah. So I'll be sure to tweet that out. But if you have any questions, always tweet them to @CleatsCufflinks or @JeffSnader, @NickDarling, and we'll get to it. So let's start off. Segment one. Deflategate. Now,
is there anybody who doesn't know what this is? Like, do we need to premise this?
If they don't know what it is, I don't care.
If you don't know what it is,
why are you listening?
Hit pause on your podcast. Yeah. And Google.
Just turn on the
Deflategate, or turn on ESPN.
Yeah, just turn on the TV
because
on any channel.
Literally, they can't talk about anything else.
And you know, this is there's kind of two parts to this. One, I can't stand it. It drives me insane. I don't even know what the matchups are. Like, there's no good controversy or story to me about this, about the Super Bowl whatsoever.
Oh, there's still a Super Bowl?
Exactly, right?
Well, I thought it was just turned into a court case that we were going to get to enjoy.
I mean, they're not talking about matchups or who can beat who or anything. It is literally just about the Deflategate, and I can't stand it. I don't also think it's so irrelevant to how the game ended that, as a fan, I just don't care.
Mm.
What do you think?
See, Johnny Mack made an analogy that I kind of liked, though I don't think he said it quite well enough, so you weren't on board with it. So I'm not as big a football fan as you are. We all
You're
know that.
You're
not
as big of anything as I am.
it's also true. Yeah, I'm smaller in most ways. ego, size.
Brain.
Nah, you've seen my head size.
Right.
The thing about it, he made an analogy that I liked. He said, and even as a casual fan of football, I kind of agree with him on this. If you cheat, you cheat, right? It doesn't matter if you were going to win. If you didn't cheat, the fact that you cheated still blemishes that thing. So I was a teacher. I don't know if you recall that. I was a teacher mm-hmm. years ago. I taught history. And if I had a student who was an F student and cheated and ended up getting a C, or at an A student who cheated and got an A+. The punishment for both of those things is the same. It's a failing grade on that test. And so my reaction, my knee-jerk reaction to this thing was, you know, again, it becomes this CSI-style case, as you brought up earlier when we were talking. But my knee-jerk reaction is, if it's proven that they cheated, then they cheated. It doesn't matter how much it affected the game or how little. The fact of the cheating is a problem.
Knowingly, purposefully cheated.
Yeah. You made a decision to knowingly go against the rules to try to gain some sort of advantage, even if it turns out you didn't really need that advantage.
I agree with you with that. I was coming at it with a fan. I was a fan. I just don't care about the ball. If I was competing in it, I wouldn't care. Like, I haven't heard Andrew Luck. I don't know if they asked him or asked any of the Colts, but they're going to say, look, we lost the game 45-7 or whatever the score was, so it doesn't matter. So, again, as a fan, I don't care. Now, do I think the NFL has some of the weirdest policy when it comes to punishment? And I said it feels more like CSI than a real investigation. And, you know, the whole Ray Rice thing should open your eyes to they had one rule 1 minute and the next rule the next minute, and then Ray Rice is this and Adrian Peterson's this, and it was, you know, so.
Their inconsistency is definitely problematic for them. I think you pointed out, though, one of the problems with this scenario. So, well, thinking about this from the league's perspective, just for fun, you find out that this happened. Say you find out at the end of the game that it happened, right, that half the balls were less inflated than the other half.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't know that anyone did anything intentionally to make that the case, for sure, right? So your decision is either to bring that up to everyone's attention and try to deal with it quickly and make some sort of decision on that, or to try to just ignore it for as long as you can so that you can get to the Super Bowl, which is the game you have to run because you make so much money off that game.
Right.
And everything rides on it. If you had evidence that was conclusive, you might have been able to make a conclusive move at that point. Now, whether or not you take that game away from the Patriots or not, I don't know. We can talk about what we would do in that case. But the idea that you could make some kind of conclusive decision would be great. But if you can't make a conclusive decision, it's from a PR perspective, from a getting the game done perspective, it's almost better to delay, to drag your feet, and to wait until after the Super Bowl's over to talk about it. And I get that approach. As much as I have trouble with the NFL's approach to a lot of their disciplinary things and a lot of that, from a PR perspective, I kind of get it. This is a tough situation.
It from PR perspective. I mean, now we're getting to the business side of it. Again, as if I were commissioner, I would make it really clear that that this was a highly punishable offense. Because like you said, cheating's cheating, right? Cheating's cheating. Now, there is foul play. There's flagrant play. There's heated play. There is poor sportsmanship. All these things, all different than cheating, which is doctoring, you know, stealing signals, doctoring equipment,
right?
Any of those things, right?
Holding penalty is not cheating. You held the guy when he was trying to get to the quarterback. That's not cheating. That's a penalty.
Right.
You know, cheating is
punching.
Yeah, cheating
is
doing
cheating,
stuff that are that's outside of the game, that's affecting the game. It's, you know, shaving weight off of your car, right? Don't they do that in NASCAR? Isn't that a thing?
There's huge penalties for it. So before the game, if they can confirm that they're cheating, then I would, and I thought about this a lot, I think you remove the Patriots from the game because you say it's unacceptable. And
right.
Because, you know, it's like drugs. You can't say, well, a little bit of drugs is okay. We've learned that zero tolerance drug policies are the way you do things, right? It's just the best way to do things.
You got to get rid of the gray area.
Zero tolerance cheating. If they find out afterwards, I think you punish the program through draft picks and even, like you said, coach firing or whoever was responsible, but you also punish draft picks.
You got to suspend Belichick in this situation. If it turns out they did this, how do you not suspend the coach?
Yeah.
Think about what they did to what's the Saints guy, right, with the whole bounty situation.
His name shot out of my head, but I could picture him.
Yeah. My point is they used that punishment there, and look how devastating that was to the Saints organization. There's no way that they're going to get caught in a similar situation again because they can't afford it.
Yeah.
Right? They can't afford the PR problems that cause it. They can't afford the the record that they had without their coach on the sideline.
For a year.
A coach is a big deal in this game.
Yeah.
You know, football is the most coach-centric sport I can think of. Can you think of one that's more coach-centric? I mean, it's so...
There's so many coaches.
It's so managed by the coaching staff. It's their game, really. And the players, their performance has an effect, but it could be canceled out by a bad coaching decision. And Belichick, I think we can all agree, regardless of how we feel about his moral ambiguity in terms of the rules, is probably the best coach that we've seen in who knows how long in the NFL.
And he's been caught cheating before, too. And
he has. Now, this is again, a consistent problem.
He didn't get punished, right? What did they charge him?
They took some draft picks away or something. But he was stealing plays. Like, you got it. I mean, you got it. As the NFL, you have to make that impossible to do, especially, and again, I come back, I think about these things from PR perspectives all the time. You're in a situation as the NFL where Goodell is clearly good friends with Robert Kraft. Like, that's an obvious relationship that exists. It's like with your kid, right? My mom was my teacher in fourth grade. She taught my class. And my punishments were way harsher than the other kids when they happened because she needed to show that there wasn't any favoritism there, right? Needed to prove it. So if you have a situation like this where you clearly have relationship between some of the higher-ups in these organizations, you have a coach who's been caught cheating once, and this looks like he may be caught cheating again.
Yeah.
Like, what do you do? And he always pushes the rules, and that's okay. Like, he tests the rules any place he can. But when you step over the line to literally breaking them, they got to step in and do something.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to say that I don't know how good friends Goodell is with Kraft. I don't know any of this stuff. I think the whole thing...
It doesn't matter if it's true.
Yeah.
What matters is it's a PR issue that exists.
It still just feels like... I mean, it's their business. This is what happens when you're fat and happy. Their business is so running so well for so long, and they're just cruising along, right? And it's the NFL has run very well. But still, they can make so many mistakes and still be fat and happy that they're spoiled by it.
Well, and then here's the question. Here's the question for you, right? Does this at all affect the Super Bowl ratings?
I don't know.
Because that's what it comes down to.
It's just a weird question because it's like when you're, again, fat and happy, like when you are talking about a 48 rating, you know what I mean? Wow, it went down to a 47 or it went up to a 49.
I mean, a 46 rating is still a big difference from a 48 rating to your sponsors. It's big numbers.
It's just, we're talking about a 48, though. You know, they're just.
Yeah, it's true.
They're just so high up.
There's a lot of padding.
You know? So I don't know if it does. I'll tell you what it does do. It chips away at the foundation of the game. It really does. If Deflate Gate, because this, so I go back to, well, this is still from a business perspective, but it's like, but also a fan perspective. If Deflate Gate is the story, then what's next year? Are we now moving away from players versus players and strategy versus strategy and just, you know, what's been done? I mean, this is just bad. And if I'm in charge of that league, I don't want the integrity of the game to be lost because that's the best business decision because sooner or later, if I do, somebody will come along and make a league where the integrity of the game is intact, and that is more appetizing to watch. Right? Look at boxing. Boxing died.
Yeah,
because the integrity of the game was lost. And the thought anymore that, you know, Joe could beat, you know, Jack was lost. It was like, well, just one of them is going to dive. And that ruins it.
I think you're right about that. Though I think even if they're able to correct their disciplinary system and their reactions to things, I think we've entered, you know, the era we're in right now, sports are only partially the sport on the field and the integrity of that game. And they're much larger, an entertainment product that thrives on controversy, that thrives on scandal. What is TV now? TV is...
Controversy is different than
what are
scandal.
The most popular shows on TV? They're all reality shows.
New Girl.
Your favorite, New Girl.
American Idol.
Yeah, it's kind of a reality show.
So you think you can dance? You're right. It's all scandal.
It's all scandal.
No, but, it's not. No, scandal's the wrong word. It's not scandal. It's controversy. It's on drama. But scandal ruins it. Scandal's what ruined boxing. Controversy was always there. The best boxing in the
scandal
world.
Scandal around the sport ruined boxing. Scandal about the game itself. Because you're right. You still have to have an. The game is still so important. It has to exist in its pure form at the core of this
Muhammad
monster
Ali
you build
going
around it.
Back and forth with George Foreman or Joe Louis is the height of boxing. The downfall of boxing is when they didn't know who was throwing the fight next, right?
Yeah, it just came down to the point where both of them were throwing the fight.
Right? So yeah, both
very
of them
uncomfortable.
They both just fall over, right? That's the wrong scandal. Yeah. So you know that's the integrity I'm talking about. You can't lose it, and I see it chipping away because we're seeing it.
Oh, and people, I mean, they talk. I mean, year by year, I feel like the noise around the NFL gets louder and louder about that kind of stuff, about whether or not
concussions are real.
Yeah, whether or not concussions are real.
Remember the concussion-proof helmets and all this other stuff, and now they backed away from that. Those things. The integrity of their game is suffering. So, you know, we talked about it. We talked about why what we would do, but. Maybe as a recap, again, if it's me, someone has to pay. Somebody has to pay dearly. Enough that nobody would ever do it again, right?
The organization has to be badly hurt, and because that's where all the pride lies. And if you hurt the organization, then you hurt the people who back it, and you change the culture.
Yeah. So tell us what you think. I'd like to hear from the fans. If you think there's a good punishment for Deflategate. Again, assume it's true. Assume they did it on purpose. I'd love to, and that we could prove it. I'd love to hear what you think.
I like the one I saw the other day that the Patriots have to play with beach balls all of next year instead of footballs.
But what if they win?
Just hyperinflated beach balls.
Okay. I still would worry.
Yeah.
That Tom Brady could find a way.
And yeah.
It would be really frustrating.
It's irritating.
And but while we're in this football thing, it leads me to this show I watched. On what, A&E or something, completely out of the blue. Oh,
nice segue into our next segment, Jeffrey. Yeah. I like this.
Well, now you've ruined it.
Well, no, I couldn't help it. I've never seen you do it so smoothly. Yeah. I wanted to, I like to break anything you do well.
They don't call me, first of all, again, smooth. You like the fact that it was smooth.
Don't get into the peanut butter discussion.
Peanut butter smooth is better. I didn't do it chunky.
I just chunked it up.
Yeah, you just chunked it up and it ruined it.
It was delicious.
The smooth is so much better. Creamy, I think it is. Friday Night Tykes on A&E is like Friday Night Lights. They're showing these football programs with youth. I mean, I don't know how old the kids were. Eight to nine.
They looked tiny.
Right.
I've only seen some clips of the show because you mentioned it to me the other day, and I watched some clips.
And they're in some serious football towns, right, where football is really serious. So I want to paint a couple things before we even talk about it. These were a couple of towns are showing were not wealthy towns by any stretch, right? They're kind of your normal or even lower class neighborhoods, okay? The show they're putting, the games they're putting on, the uniforms they're wearing were nicer than ours, right? So you could just tell that, like, this was football town. Like, the football meant everything, everything about what they were doing, the way the coaches talked. The way you could tell how they took the game was extremely serious. And this is what this is highlighting, what youth football's like. Then some things really hit me. The coaches are talking to – a couple coaches are suspended for cheating, for gaming systems, for cursing too much, for doing a lot of things that we just have learned are just not the right things to do in sports and in youth sports anymore. And I also want to break there and say, I don't think any of these coaches, which we're about to talk to in these programs, are bad people. I'm sure there can be bad people in there. I think they're so in a box, and they're so ignorant that they don't know any better. And to highlight this, one of the coaches says, we don't have concussions here, right? So anyway, I'm jumping around, but here's the scene. These coaches are yelling at these kids, right? Like you would to a platoon of men, right, as, you know, like in the military, which is as years of proven effectiveness, right? Like, this is what you do.
And yet a trifle intense, perhaps.
Right. It's you know, it's a thing to go out to war, which football's a violent sport. And they're yelling at these kids and all this stuff. Then they show this one kid get hit. Remember, this kid is 10, 11 years old, and he is laying on the ground just dying, right? He's moaning, right? And he's not even writhing in pain because he's not moving. He's just moaning. And now that, you know, I'm a father, now you're a father, it was hard, like, God, this is terrible. There's a young kid moaning, and the coach is around him, and after 30 seconds, I say, come on, man, get up and walk it off. Get up and walk off your head injury, right?
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, boy. Like, there's a lot of history and a lot of, what do you call it? The way we do things is there, and it's scary because it hasn't caught up. It hasn't gotten through to there where this is just not the way we deal with youth sports. So anyway, as I go through this, I think there's a question I have, which is, what should be the difference between professional sport and youth sport? What should be, there should, we should be able to talk about their difference. Professional, because professional soccer should be different than youth soccer. They should be different. But I don't know how. How do you say how? Or professional baseball. And professional football's easy because it's violent. And there's a very clear thing of, well, we should do this differently. But that doesn't mean you couldn't damage a kid in soccer the same way. You're just with the mental aspect of it, of the pressure and those things. Or is the pressure good for him? Or is this just where the wheat and chaff separate? You know what I mean?
Well, I think every sport has tackled this a little bit differently. Baseball is interesting, right? You have quite a variation in rules throughout T-ball and Little League, and like they change rules all the way up through to try to let people grow into the sport. I feel like it's kind of well developed in that way, to some extent, in my mind anyway. Football is interesting. I heard someone talk about the fact one of the biggest concussion problems that they have in football are these subconcussive events. And one of the easiest fixes that we're hearing from a lot of writers is stand the linemen up. When they're down in that three-point position and they're diving forward into each other, that is one of the biggest impacts that happens in the game. If they start in a standing position, then they're grappling. They're not hitting, they're grappling. And it would be a very easy thing to fix, at least at the youth level. Stand them up, get them out of that thing where they're bashing their heads against each other in the first second. Play after play after play after play after play, through practice, through games, etc. It's not good for anyone's brain. And teach them to block and rush the passer in that upright mode, that grappling style mode. It's a really interesting thing. There's little things like that that I think you can introduce into any sport. You know, we talk a lot about Ultimate, that we would like to work on a disc that is safer for really young kids to play with. You know, fewer broken noses, let's say.
Yeah.
You know, because it's hard, and those kids don't have good control over it. They're just winging it at each other.
Yeah, I mean, a kid could throw it 35, 40 miles an hour.
Yeah. My son hit me in the face with a disc golf disc a couple weeks ago. And it was incredibly painful. And he's two.
Yeah.
He whipped that thing right into my lip.
So let's bring that disc in and just...
You want to frame it?
I want to frame it, yep. Yeah, because I'm proud of that disc.
Yeah, there's a little blood on it still. So that's my point. I don't think it has to be... I think sometimes people worry if you change too many things, they're not going to learn the sport properly, and it's going to, you know, it's going to affect, again, the integrity of the game and all that stuff. But there's little changes you can make.
Okay, so let's agree that you should make changes to each sport in terms of overall safety.
Safeties, yeah.
Okay, so good. Absolutely. So we agree on that. Now I want to talk about the philosophy of coaching, though, or teaching. Can I go up to a bunch of 10-year-olds and say, and treat them the way I would treat one of our professional teams? Can I give them the same type of talk I would give the New York Rumble? Can I tell them that? Can I give them the same amount of pressure? Or is there something that needs to be – is there a certain guideline there? This is a great –
That's such a tough one because I remember being a kid and having some good coaches that spoke to us like we were men. And, like, we were going out and we were playing the most important game we've played to date. And here's what you're going to do, and here's how you're going to do it. And you got to live up to these expectations you built for yourself and all the hard work you put. Right, that whole talk. And it was amazingly motivating. I was like, it was the, you know, as a 12, 13-year-old out on the soccer field, it was the first time anyone had treated me like an adult responsible for something. I liked that, right? But then at the same year, I had a basketball coach who would take us into the locker room and scream curses at us throughout the entire halftime, to the point where he got fired pretty quickly because basketball locker rooms are not terribly well insulated. But my point is I don't know that it's about the pressure as much as it's about the delivery. And you know this because you've coached and you're a very good coach. There's understanding the player that you're dealing with too. Some players thrive from having pressure dumped on them. Some thrive from being pushed in different ways. And it doesn't matter if it's a 10-year-old or a 25-year-old, I don't think. I think that a coach needs a level of understanding. And I know you have, I'm sure, a different, more elaborate opinion on this one.
No, I mean, I think that I have something clear I could say I think should be different. So with my Frisbee coaching career, coaching twice in USAU Nationals and then once with the spinners in the ADL. I can remember the losses. Like, I mean, I was devastated with the losses. And, there was a year in Nationals where Southpaw played double wide, and I knew we were going to win the game. I knew it. I saw the strategy in my head, everything. I saw the matchups, and I knew we were going to win. And we were winning at some point. And then it just fell apart right at the end. Winning was everything to me. You know what I mean? Not that everything else didn't mean anything, but it was my number one thing was winning. And I think that is acceptable with grown-ups, with adults. Mm. And in the spinners, I think it's acceptable that at the end of the day when we lost a game that it was clear that it was about winning, that there wasn't some greater purpose, that it was that's our job to win and it was the most important thing. So if I'd say the difference is, in youth sports, I do not think that winning is allowed to be everything. It's just not their time yet. I wish I had a good analogy set up, but, you know, I don't know. If you're a journeyman, off the top of my head, if you're a journeyman plumber, right, you don't get to finish. You don't get the big jobs. You don't get to finish or do the crazy jobs. You have to do the smaller jobs. You have to have someone watch you. You have to earn your way up to top to be a master plumber. It's like if you want to play just to win, you have to go through all these other things and learn all this other stuff that would make you a strong, good person, good athlete, good competitor. And if kids are stuck to just winning, and if coaches are stuck to just that, you're losing so many things. And there's no way, I don't know how you do it.
Yeah.
Because you need to learn how to compete.
Because you got
to
be competitive.
Who cares if you win at the end? Like if you're in youth sports, you have so many years in front of you. If you're coaching a high school football team and you win, that's great. But if you hurt your kids in the process, if you, you know, had to destroy a few kids' sense of self-esteem to get there, what was the point? They're kids. You know, they're learning. A grown-up has made a choice. I've come here to compete in this arena.
Yeah.
A kid just went to school, you know, or a kid just had their parents enter them. So that's my delineation.
It's interesting to think about where that level is, where that changeover is, though, right? Is it professional or is it, you know, varsity, high school? Like, where does the change happen? Where does it start to become different? And in keeping with what you said, I think not only does it not have to be all about winning, but I think an important thing that coaches need to be able to teach kids is about losing. You have to lose.
Yeah.
If you've never lost, you don't know how to lose. You don't know how to play the next game if you've never lost before.
Yeah.
You know, it's the bike ride thing. You got to fall down. You know, I think about this with my kids all the time because I don't want my kids to get hurt. Very protective in a lot of ways. I'm nervous. and we live in a house with all concrete floors. But you gotta let them fall. You know, kids have to fall down. They're very durable.
They are very durable.
If I fell some of the ways that my son fell,
your ACL would be up
dead.
In your,
I would
your
just
shoulder.
Be dead.
Yeah.
There would be a funeral tomorrow. He came running in the room, just bit it the other day, and I that both my knees would be broken because he fell onto them.
They're not made of anything.
Then he hit his head.
They're all rubber at this age. Yeah. So.
It's terrible.
All right, no, wait, we're saying the wrong things now. It's like we're saying that. Just make him play some football.
So just let him, who cares?
Let him play. They'll be fine.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I mean, again, you bring out the points, and finding the area where it is tough, but it doesn't matter that it's tough. You still have to do it.
Yeah.
I think here's what I think. Here's a good thing. Schools, so high schools, elementary schools, need to understand that they need to evaluate their coaches on their competitive precedence, right? What do you think is more important than winning, right? Now, if it's nothing, you are a dangerous coach. Right?
Yeah, but you try to get into that in some of these high schools where the boosters are all about winning.
Yeah, this is a tough problem. An easy thing. But if you can start pushing it where athletic directors or school principals are held accountable for this, now you have something new, right? You need to make sure that you have coaches whose winning is everything attitude is the only thing attitude is not allowed. And if it's there, it's bad. And you have something, you know, because it's myopic. You can grow up and do a lot of great things without having to learn that winning at all costs, right? Because I never had that as a kid.
So,
really didn't.
So hard for me.
Yeah.
I really like winning.
Here's the other thing. You bring up the point. I would say most coaches who have this are making up for old time, lost time.
Yeah.
They're trying to achieve what they didn't have. And, you know, after this Friday Night Tykes show came on this golf show, you can see crazy people, right? Kids trying to make their kids the next Tiger Woods, right?
Oh, yeah.
And very interesting juxtaposition between different fathers. But you could tell one father just didn't make it himself, and he really wanted his kid to make it. The other father, this is something they did as a family. He was a golfer, and they all do it together. And he said, he always gave that kid the choice, and she chooses to play golf. Now, look, he's really lucky. His kid loves golf, and he's got it good. The other guy is lucky that his kid does like golf, but he, you know, needs more pushing. But in the end, who are you doing it for? Are you doing it for you?
I think that's maybe the question to ask. If you're a coach, and you're coaching a high school team, that's maybe the question that's most telling. Who are you doing it for?
Yeah. How do you find that out, right?
I know.
That's tough.
That's a lot of self-reflection.
That's tough. But, we can move on. But I would say that coaches out there should be able to teach their kids, their youth, how to have and what it looks like to have an intense desire to win. But they should not teach them that winning is everything, right? It's like... Because that's a great thing. And, you know, we have very good competitors here. Like, God, this office is very competitive, right? And we have people here who have an intense desire to win. All of us, we can get extremely competitive.
Or maybe more accurately, an extreme hatred of losing.
Which is what I think great competitors are, right?
Yeah.
But, while no one likes it, you can tell they've been taught well.
Yeah.
Everyone here has been taught well as to what being competitive is. And if we didn't, then you start to see stuff like cheating or gaming or things like that. Like, you know that any game we play here, the person would never cheat.
Ever.
Right? Because they would find that as
because they would feel
weakness.
Like they lost.
Yeah, they would feel like they're losing. So, whatever. It's a tough, tough thing, but...
That's the thing that I find interesting about Belichick, right? He seems to have this... Going back to our earlier conversation, he seems to have this, again, moral ambiguity where he... is willing to bend the rules, stretch rules, and break the rules in order to win in a way that, to me, like again, I'm not a huge football fan. It's appalling to me because I can't imagine enjoying a win that I accomplished in that way.
Yeah, going back to that for a moment, you also don't know who's cheating. There's so many darn people in there. You don't know if Belichick is cheating. You don't know who deflated
the ball. It's his ship, though.
Right, no, it is. My point is he just might be like, why? Why did you deflate the – you know, he might not know anything. So, of course, But he might not have that attitude. His attitude would be like, might be, look, we can beat him 45-7. We don't need to do any gaming stuff. So anyway, you're right, though. It's his ship, but it's interesting. You know, I don't know whose attitude is that way. Or is Brady's attitude that way? Is Brady Mr., you know, let's game the system?
Might be.
So he's too good looking. Don't take him off the pedestal.
I don't trust him.
All the women love him. All the men love him.
That's what I don't trust about him.
Yeah, he's too good looking.
I got to say one more thing about this Friday night tag scene, though.
Okay.
What is the NFL saying about this? Because this is this show that is violently in opposition of all of their PR right now. All their PR is this, like, what are they, heads up coaching thing that they do, the Play 60 stuff where it's all this sort of safe play thing. And they're like, this is where your players are. This is football.
Right.
Like, what you're talking about is not football. Like, you have no cameras on this football, which is where probably, you know, the driving force behind what's happening on that field is what's going on the NFL field.
Yeah.
That's where they're getting it all.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. They're staying as far away from that thing as possible.
Yeah, I just don't know how you deal with it as a league, because it's clear that your messaging is inconsistent with what's happening on the ground. And the fact that the show exists is, you know, phenomenal, and I wish there were more information on this type of stuff. You know, the scrutiny is hard to escape now as a league, and you know we'll find that as we get bigger and bigger, as more and more people start watching us, the scrutiny is hard to escape. You know,
we can't escape it now.
It's already tough.
That's going to give you a segue into the next.
What I did for you.
It does.
I did that for you right there.
No, because the next thing we're talking about, Jordan Belfour, who is the Wolf of Wall Street.
Segment three.
I watched this movie. I enjoyed the movie because I thought this is a fun movie and it's, you know, it's fiction. And then I found out, okay, it's not fiction. It's a real person. And then you read about him and read his stuff. And he's got an interesting story.
He does.
He is one of those guys who's screwed up a ton. But now it would seem in his life that he wants to teach from his screw ups, right? He considers himself a kind of a bad egg maybe that learned a lot throughout the way and would have done stuff differently.
Yeah, you know? I haven't seen much of anything after that movie. Like, I haven't read any of his self help kind of things that he does now.
He's more like a
coaching stuff that he does.
Yeah.
I haven't read any of that stuff really. I haven't looked at any of that. So my, you know, my impression is colored by the articles I've read about him and the movie. So, you know,
he was trapped in greed. I mean, he was obsessed.
Massively obsessed.
Yeah. Here's the quick story about it, if you don't know. He was a top-notch, God-given, brilliant salesman. And in his – so, you know, you guys watch the movies. You hear about, like, how – what do they call it? Is it a piker? Is that what it is? When you have to sit down and just – slam on the phones, right? Like, for 6 months, you just have to get on the phone.
You're just on the phone.
Right? 6 months, he's on the phone, and he's at this firm, and I forget what it is. He gets his, whatever that license is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Gets his license, and his first day, he's a real broker. The stock market crashes.
Yeah.
And everyone goes out of business. So he ends up going and selling penny stocks. He walks into a place where he's selling them for triple what everybody else is selling them for. He just was a natural.
Yeah, penny stocks are a crazy thing, right? It's just you're selling stock in a company that started out of a garage somewhere. It's not regulated.
Right. It's not like on the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange. It's just kind of a free-for-all. And then from this, he...
Which I don't think exists anymore because of him.
It might not. I don't even know. I don't know anything about it. I don't deal with pennies. I mean, they sell penny stocks, so...
They do actually sell penny stocks.
So he ends up making an enormous amount of money, almost $1 million a week through some of his time.
He was disappointed at one point because he only made $48 million that year.
$51
million. Or $51
million. Yeah.
And he could have made $1 million a week.
So, you know, basically he could teach people how to sell and do all this stuff, and he was brilliant at it. Now, so let's fast forward now. He got in a whole bunch of trouble for all this other stuff. He talks about his four keys to life success. We've talked about these in some ways before, but there's two in here I really liked. Number one was vision. We talk about this all the time, right? Like, how the heck are you going to start the MLU? You have to have some sort of vision. You can't just be like, oh, I think something's going to happen. You have to see something in your brain that is like, this is what we're chasing.
You got to see the end and work backward. Absolutely how things work.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so, it's, did you ever do that when you were a kid? You do the mazes, like on the back of the menu at the Denny's, and you do the maze. Did you ever start in the middle of the maze and work your way back to the start? It's easier. I don't know why it's easier.
Start in the middle of the maze?
You start at the end, wherever the end is. So sometimes the end's in the middle, like you're going to the middle.
Saying, yeah.
Start at the end of the maze and go backward to the beginning. It's easier.
Yeah.
And this is the thing with vision. Vision is made... makes the path easier.
You gotta
because
remember,
you see the end of it.
My brain could just see the entrance and exit from one take.
It is actually true. You have a very weird brain. Okay. Well.
But no, you're right. You're right. That's a very, very good point. So vision is easy. I think people understand. Well, they know it. It's hard to understand it sometimes, but vision's important. Number two is strategy. You have to have a strategy for achieving the vision. You can't be like, okay, like I'm going to put 100 blocks on top of each other. But those 100 blocks will be 100 feet tall, and I'm only 6 feet tall. Like, you need a strategy, right? How are you going to make it happen? And let me tell you what, trying something like this, there's 50 strategies because there's 50 things going on all the time, right? So it's crazy. But strategy and vision are easy. Those make sense.
They make sense.
Right?
Yet, I like that you put them in there, and I respect it because while they make sense, they're very difficult.
Very difficult.
People mistake a dream for vision.
Right.
People mistake a wish for vision.
Yep.
And then people mistake optimism for strategy.
Or passion for strategy.
Passion for strategy.
Yeah. Passion is not
like,
strategy.
I'm just going to work really hard, and then it's going to happen. Like, that's not strategy. It's good. You need to work hard. I feel like that might be coming up, but.
Yeah, no. None of these are work hard. That's the point.
Oh, I like that.
So here's the ones that really get to me. You need to erase or control and understand your limiting beliefs. If you think you can only be, if you think you can only be 7 out of 10, then you'll never be 8 out of 10. Because you put the stop there, right? If you think you can be 10 out of 10, then you'll be 10 out of 10, or at least you have a chance. And if you think that the scale's wrong and it should go up to 11, Spinal Tap, then you can do that. You know, like you can do these things. And his point was people believe something that just isn't true most of the time. They think, wow, you know, I'm not smart enough or I started too late. You know, it wasn't Eric Clapton started playing guitar at 16 or 15 or something.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, that's ridiculous. Eric Clapton plays guitar better than just about anybody. And he started 12 years after anybody who had any expertise would tell you have to start to be able to play like him. Right?
Lionel Messi, one of the older kids to get brought into the Barcelona Academy.
Right, so he was
13 or 14 at the time.
It's like Luke Skywalker, right? He was too old, right?
You're too old.
Too old. So, was that your Yoda?
No, I didn't get to Yoda yet.
Okay, that was just...
I don't know what that was. Why did I say it that way?
Was that old Han Solo?
Too old you are.
well done. I have lived through this myself. I've had these moments of being like, what am I doing? You know, I didn't graduate college. I had to go into the Marines, right, because I was lost when I was young. I've failed multiple businesses I've created. Like, who am I?
Yeah.
Why should I be able to do anything? But at the same time, I have had moments of being like, so what? Right? So what? So I screwed up. I learned, and I marched forward, and I didn't quit. I just moved. I just, you know, took my hit and kept on moving, you know. And at some point in your life, you're old enough or hopefully mature enough to be like, so what? Why all the negative that's happened in my life? Why does that matter? It's only made me stronger. And I really like that he brings that up because I think so many people we talk to, and so many people who want to start businesses, and again, these are four keys to life success, right?
Yeah,
getting things you want. How many times do we hear people say, "I would, but I can't"? There's always a but this. Yeah, but I have to do this. Yeah, well, when I get to here, I'll do that. Okay. Always something limiting you.
The limiting belief thing. I like that a lot. I think about that as a parent, too. Like, trying, you try to do so many things. You're going to screw it all up. Let's be honest about this. As parents, mm-hmm. you're going to screw it all up. Any parents out there, mm-hmm. you've already screwed it all up. It's okay, though.
Yep.
Just love them. It'll be fine. But I do think about this a lot. where are there points where unconsciously I'm introducing these kind of limiting beliefs to my children? These things that say that, you know, you can do this and this, but you can't do this. And I worry about that.
Yeah.
And I think about it very consciously because I know that one of the reasons that I'm sitting here next to you on these microphones is that despite all of my insecurities, because I have them, mm-hmm. they're many and varied. My parents, I think, I'm going to give them credit, did a great job of providing me with a limitless belief in what I can accomplish. Now, the path I'm going to take and how much it's going to hurt and sting a little bit and make me uncomfortable, I see that all the time, every day. So but nice, I don't believe that there's an obstacle there.
Nice job, darling parents. I like it.
Nice job, darling parents. Thanks, Mom and Dad.
Yeah, you know, same. You know, there's something in your life that told you you could do it.
Yeah.
Told you that it would be worse if you didn't, right? Now, here's the last one. And this is the one that it stings my pickle. My pickle's my sting.
Let's not say either of those things again.
Nope, stop. Me when it's in your head. I meant my head, okay? Nick, God, what's your problem? Anyway, managing your state. Now, this is what he means. He said managing your emotions.
Yeah,
so
right.
He says, as you go through these things, as you're chasing your vision, you have your strategy, right? You've got your limited, you're controlling your limited beliefs, and now you're working hard and doing this whole thing. Your emotions can tear you to pieces, right? The mm-hmm. fear, the sadness, the loneliness, all the things that happen as you do this. And he says, managing your state and your emotions is critical. And he goes on to say, this is why so many successful people use drugs and drink.
Yeah, he did it very chemically.
Right? He said, I wish that I didn't do it, but all of my drug use allowed me to do this because it gave me confidence. It controlled my emotions. Aerosmith, Steven Tyler said, I wish we hadn't done all the drugs, but doing those drugs in that time gave us some confidence. But once we stopped doing them, we wrote so much more music. So it's an interesting one. So let me be clear. I'm not advocating at all using drugs.
No.
I'm saying I understood better after reading more from him why people do it. Because he's right that when you have something and you have these other three things, that the fourth one is something you can't prescribe. You have to say, look, all right, now go control your emotions. People are going to – your friends and family are going to tell you you're crazy. Mm-hmm. They're going to pick you apart. People are going to shut the door in your face a million times. You're going to work so much that the friends who didn't tell you you're crazy, you're not going to see as much. You're going to strain relationships, all these things.
Every single misspeak you have, every wrong thing you type on Twitter is going to get noticed and thrown back at you.
If you say pickle weirdly.
Yep, that's going to come up. We're going to hear about that. And the fact that you've advocated drug use in this segment.
So
now, I really like this one. And it makes me, like, I have respect for the guy. Like, he lived that portion of his life terribly in a lot of ways.
He was consumed by greed.
He was consumed by greed. He was
and pride.
Callously dismissive of the people who loved and cared about him to a point that was insane in my mind.
Well, also the people he was serving. He said, you know, the money he took from people, he said, you know, they weren't going to spend it right anyway, so I might as well spend it for him.
He had a Robin Hood mentality, yeah. But without giving any of it back.
Yeah, I mean, you skew your mind.
Yeah,
you make a justification.
But what I like about this, and what I think speaks to what you were saying, is that absolutely, emotions will ruin you. Your ability to deal with stress and anxiety, and you know, feeling overwhelmed and feeling like it will kill you. It will mm-hmm. absolutely kill you. And the shortcut can be substances, right? Can be drugs, things like that. It's the hard work is building something that lasts. And it's not just building a business that lasts. You have to make yourself last. You have to build not only your support personally and with yourself, but you got to have people around you who are going to prop you up and do that too. And that's the thing I think he misses in his points, right? You got to control your state. But your state is not just you. Your state is the people around you too. You have to have your state.
Yes.
State of living, not your state of being yourself.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. So this is what you, a point just what I want to make something similar, which is I don't do drugs. I did drugs a few times when I was in my high school phase. But, you know, I found out kind of through some time it wasn't really good for me. You know, I didn't do well with any drugs, and it didn't help me.
I don't even do well with ibuprofen.
Right, yeah, I mean, so I don't do any drugs anymore, and I don't think that drugs, you know, if anyone who's out there feels the pressure, it's not drugs, right? That is not going to help you. It might help you for a little bit, but it's someday, look at everyone who's ever done them, there's a huge cliff to fall off of. So stay away from drugs, right? But like he said, and we've talked about, and believe me, Nick and I, you know, I think anyone listening to this knows Nick and I could talk about this, you know, now that we're much more public than anything we've ever thought, you have a lot of negativity towards you. And this can come from even your parents, right? You know, and, you know, we're very lucky, but still people can go out there and say, hey, I want to go start a business. And their mom or dad can say, that's stupid, right? So like you said, to control your state, you need to have somebody or a few or whatever, just a few people that are in your corner no matter what.
Just
right?
Literally no matter what.
Yeah, I read this article about
extreme.
Yeah, that the best thing you could say, the three best things you could say to your kid before they went out to play their game, like a little league game, and after. And he said, but the number one best thing you could say when your child was done playing the game and comes up to you afterward is, I loved watching you play. Didn't matter if you got to hit a home run, struck out, right? Everybody needs this. There are people who I have in my life who will say, I just love what you do, right? I love seeing all the things you've done. And that means a lot because most of the people I come into contact with want to tell me how to run the business, want to tell me their ideas.
Always.
Want to tell me what we should have done better, right? Yep. And it's draining. It's very, very tiring. And the way I manage my state is that I understand that now much better, and I give that so much less value. I give the people who I value now who care about me and my state, I give that much more value.
Yeah.
But I didn't always do that in life. I used to give the wrong people the value, and therefore the negativity can drive you to have sleepless nights, to be angry, to drink, to do all those things. It's a tough lesson.
It's a tough lesson. And it's a lesson, frankly, that is ongoing forever. Like, I don't think you're ever out of it. There are still sleepless nights. There are still bad days. Always. But, yeah, I like that. You gotta have some people. You got to have some people.
Or just one person.
Shout-outs to Marie and Lori.
Shout-outs.
Thank you. Thank you, ladies.
She just texted me that she can't stand me.
Oh, well.
that was Marie texting
Marie.
Me.
thank you for reading that message I left on the fridge to text Jeff.
We do have some good chicas.
They treat us very well.
All right, look, we're at the end of it, but what I wanted to say was anybody out there, young entrepreneurs, young people, working hard for your own success, whatever you find it, and you ever want to talk about keys to life success or anything, or chat with us, you know, send in something and we'll set up a time to chat. We're always out here to help another young entrepreneur.
Absolutely.
So it's one of my great joys is helping other people trying to do great things. So with that being said, at Jeff Snader, at Nick Darling on Twitter, at Cleats Cufflinks, if you want to ask us any questions. And we'll be back, not next week because I'm in Seattle.
Yeah.
But the week after that, we'll be sure to sit down and we'll put out some questions out there and we'll answer away.
Yeah, good show today. A lot of fun, a lot of talking. Just a lot of straight talking.
That's what we do.
No frills.
Till next time, my friend.
Cleats and Cufflinks. Jeffrey.
Nicholas.